Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we return to the second of the 10 statements that got etched in stone, three general overriding statements that made it onto the first of those two tablets, and then seven specific instructions that were on the second of the two tablets. So on the first of those tablets, we have three overriding statements that God made to focus our attention, to provide perspective in our midst, so that we might understand the importance of his covenant, that he is providing fatherly advice to us, and that his name is Yahweh, that he alone is our Savior, that he is universally opposed to religion. He gave us unique insights into his character by saying that he is jealous. He gave us unique insights into the means of salvation by saying that it is afforded to thousands amongst billions, and therefore one in a million, and that it comes not by way of faith, not by way of works, but by way of observation, of not only paying attention to, observing, closely considering, and carefully considering his terms and conditions relative to the covenant, but also walking to the path that leads to him and coming to love him as a result of answering his invitations to meet with him. And then as we move on to the third general statement, we'll learn that there is one thing that really bothers God, and that's corrupting his testimony in a way that leads to lifelessness. It is an unforgivable sin. These things known, before we dig into this, we have Carol calling in on a question of marriage and divorce. Hello, Carol.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank you for being there, because this teaching is what I've been looking for a really, really long time.
Well, thank you. This teaching comes from the world's greatest teacher. Now, that would not be me, but Yahweh. His Torah is actually the Hebrew word for teaching. So what we are considering here is the teaching of Yahweh, and there is no better teacher, no more pertinent teacher, no more enlightening teacher, nor any teacher whose guidance is more valuable to us, because he teaches us how to come to know him, how to engage in a relationship with him, and how to be saved by him. So it's rather important teaching. It's also teaching on how to live our lives.
Right. Well, I'm having some problems because my husband loves Paul.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He's in the majority. So do a couple of billion other people.
Right. Well, I think one of the big reasons he does is because he has an obsession with me obeying him and him being worried of me.
Correct.
To the point, I mean, it's obsessive, and I can't live like this anymore.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about leaving, divorce, you know.
Sure. Carol, you are breaking up, but let me comment here. First of all, I am not a marriage counselor. Second of all, I never provide individual advice on a individual's circumstance. I can provide commentary, and I can provide comments, quotations of what Yahweh has to say to us, and I can share insights into why Paul ought not be trusted and why men genuinely like Paul for the reasons that you've specified. So I'm going to talk generally about these things, but I cannot and will never talk about an individual case in terms of what an individual should do.
No, I don't understand. I just want to know what the word is.
Sure. Let me give you. This is a wonderful subject. I'm very glad you brought it up. There are two reasons, and I'm going to preface this. There are two reasons that I do not get individual. One of those reasons is that I don't have any particular unique insights to share. That's why I said all I can do is tell you Yahweh's position, and I can tell you the reason that men have an affinity for Paul. And we're going to talk about both of those two things. And the second is that men who are obsessive about control have a tendency to get enraged and violent. And when I've had women who have written me, and I've taken this exact same approach with them, and their husbands then say, "What right do you have to intervene in another man's marriage?" They get very belligerent. They get violent. They get enraged. And, you know, the last thing I need is to be killed because not this time. You know, I've gotten 1,000 death threats from Muslims.
Wow.
But the last thing I want is to have more Christian idiots enraged and touting their venom. So that's why I do not ever respond individually. Now, first on Paul. Paul shared a lot in common with Muhammad. Islam became successful as a religion because of the Stockholm syndrome and the treatment of women. And so there is a great affinity between Islam and the maltreatment of women and Pauline Christianity and the abuse of women. In Islam, men have absolute control over women. They can abuse them, they can enslave them, they can punish them in any way they see fit. Women have no value and no rights in Islam. Pauline Christianity is the same thing. Just as Paul speaks of the Lord, which is Satan, who controls and possesses and owns and manipulates, the same thing is true with the Christian man over a woman. The way that one of the many ways that Paul induced Christian men to embrace his religion, Christianity is Paul's religion, it has nothing to do with Yahusha, was to give them absolute control over women. And so, matter of fact, if you look at the Pauline statement that women are subject to men and that men have control over women, you will find absolutely no support for that whatsoever in Yahweh's Torah teaching. None. In fact, Yah's position is that men and women have equal status as it relates to participating in the covenant. There's a reason why the covenant is presented as our heavenly father and spiritual mother working together. The Ruach Kodesh is feminine in Hebrew. She has all maternal aspects. And, you know, when Yahweh conceived Chawa to be, not Eve, Eve is the name of a pagan goddess, it's Chawa, which means life giver. Chawa was modeled in the to represent the set apart spirit, the Ruach Kodesh. She is the life giver, and she literally comprised out of Adam's side. You know, when you are walking side by side, and you take something out of someone's side, they're flat out equal. Now, one of the things that's so unique about God as a whole is that even he doesn't want us subjective to him. He doesn't want us referring to him as the Lord, much less to men. You know, God's whole statement is, don't subject yourself to men. Don't do that. But he doesn't say, I want you to obey me either. He doesn't say, I want you to look at me as the Lord. He says exactly the opposite. In fact, Yahusha said, all those calling me Lord, Lord, none of you are going to enter heaven. But instead, those who act upon the will and desire of the Father. And that is the perspective that Christians, men in particular, have lost. Fathers do not lord over their children. They do not control their children. They guide their children. They're there to lift up their children. They're there to nurture and support their children. They are not there to lord over them. Fathers do not lord over their family. And so, if you do not recognize Yahweh as Father, and understand that fathers get down on their knees to lift their children up, their children do not get down on their knees to worship their fathers, then you understand the very nature of the covenant that Yahweh was trying to establish. And in that covenant, in fact, just look at Yahweh's name. There are only one letter is repeated in Yahweh's name, isn't that correct? It's Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh. The letter that's repeated is drawn as an individual standing. There's two of them in God's name. The two names, the two people that are standing in God's name are both standing beside a tent peg, which is the Hebrew symbol for enlarging and securing a home. To make a home and a family, does it take two individuals? Mother and father, husband and wife, man and woman? Well, it has both of those two individuals standing side by side. Both standing up, reaching up, looking up to Yahweh. Doesn't have one of them down on her knees and the other one standing, does it? Now, God is completely opposed to everything related to obeying. You know, one of the most interesting thing is, Carol, is that there is no Hebrew word for obey.
Right.
I mean, just think of that. Christians, Pauline Christians in particular, want everyone to believe that the Torah is an obsolete set of laws to be obeyed. And that since no one can obey them, they condemn rather than save. And yet, Torah does not mean law. It means teaching. And there isn't a Hebrew word for obey. God never once says, obey me. So that whole concept of obedience, that's directly associated with the Lord's, the Pauline Lord, which is Hasatan. Now, as it relates to divorce in general, second of the seven statements that Yah etched in stone relative to instructions on the second tablet says you should not make a habit of adultery. Now, what's interesting about this, I guess that's actually the third, but because the second is dealing with our spiritual mother and Heavenly Father. What's interesting about that is that when Yahweh speaks of adultery, he almost always speaks of it relative to our relationship with him, not with our spouses. I had the opportunity to translate Paul's Romans 7, which is the most ignorant, the most utterly absurd argument I have ever heard anyone promote that is considered an intelligent individual. And Paul talks about divorce in it. And Carol, if you can stay with us, I will return and talk about what the Torah actually says about divorce. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're on the phone with Carol. We've also had Kimberly call in. We'll patch Kimberly in here in just a moment. Kimberly says that she can relate to Carol's situation, so I want to be able to communicate with both. But the thing that Carol asked for that I want to provide some insights to, and I've been chomping at the bit to get into Romans chapter 7, because I think it is one of the most insightful looks into the insane and demon-possessed mind of the founder of the Christian religion, Paul. And I don't call him insane and demon-possessed as my opinion. Paul admits that he's insane. Paul admits that he is demon-possessed. So this is not my opinion, but what Paul says about himself, while it is also the only rational conclusion. Let me introduce this review, and then we're going to go back and talk with both Carol and Kimberly. Although the words Paulos selected, Paulos, by the way, was the man's chosen name. He was born Shaul. Shaul means question him. Paulos means lowly and little in Latin. So Shaul, a name that means question him, chose not to write under his given name, but chose a Latin name representing Rome instead. Although the words Paulos selected, taken on their own merits, provide convincing proof that what he was proposing was nefarious, since the accusation that I've leveled against him, if true, would make him the most evil man who ever lived, I'd also like to share something else that is germane from this same man's sixth letter, the one he wrote to the Romans. What I'm reading from now, Kimberly and Carol, and for our other listeners, is the rewritten version of the second chapter of Questioning Paul. I'm now about halfway through my edits. I have made every chapter twice as long as it previously was by adding information to them. This particular discussion begins in clever fashion, albeit in an arrogant and condescending manner, and by using an ill-suited straw man. Before I share it, and this is what's appropriate, Carol and Kimberly, it is important that you know that the Torah provides very few instructions regarding marriage. It reveals that men and women become one in marriage. That's the story that's presented in Genesis with Adam and Chawa, that they become one. What's interesting, by the way, in that presentation, that where Yahweh said, I made them male and female, and that they become one in marriage, he said that I made them in my image. So if humankind was made male and female, and God immediately says, in my image I made them, that means that Yahweh has male and female characteristics, paternal and maternal characteristics. His maternal characteristics are manifest by the set-apart spirit. And his paternal characteristics are manifest by his role as the father of the covenant. So it reveals that men and women become one in marriage and that adultery is highly inadvisable. However, when it speaks of adultery, adultery has nothing to do with divorce. Your question was on divorce. Now, as it relates to being married and the relationships between men and women, the Torah goes on to say that you ought not engage in incest. You ought not engage in homosexuality. You ought not engage in bestiality. Now, there's some guidance regarding a woman's menstrual period, and there's some guidance showing tremendous compassion for enslaved women. You know, since such a high percentage of the population of the day were enslaved, it talks about the fair treatment, the proper treatment of an enslaved woman. And it has very succinct statements regarding divorce. And what it says of divorce, it really has non-cause divorce, if you will. It just says it's as simple as one handing the other a certificate. Just from Yah's point of view, write down from his point of view. Now, it's not going to work with the U.S. government, but from his point of view, it's just put it in writing that you want a divorce, and that's it. He doesn't say you have to have the following reasons. He doesn't say you can only do it under these circumstances. He doesn't even say don't do it. He doesn't even hint at you shouldn't do it. He just simply says that if one of the two parties wants a divorce, put it in writing and hand the other person their certificate. The lone rule regarding divorce says that if a woman remarries again and then divorces again, her first husband can't have her back. That's it. Beyond this, there's a non-binding recommendation on how a man can assist his brother's widow in the case of a childless marriage. We'll return and talk with Kimberly and Carol in a moment. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. That was a long explanation to say that the Torah says very little about divorce other than all you need if you wish to divorce a husband or a wife is to communicate that desire in writing. That said, I want to go to Kimberly, who has called in, and Carol, you're still with us here. Kimberly, I understand that you can relate to what Carol is currently facing.
Yes, I can.
Was the this answer of because, and I want to, in fact, I'll go back here to Carol here in a moment. Your husband loves Paul because he wants you to obey him, which is what Paul commands women to be submissive to, obedient to their husbands. Was it helpful to present why Paul said that, and that God has no desire whatsoever for you to be obedient even to him, much less to a human, and that he says very little about divorce. Carol?
Oh, you're talking to me. I'm sorry.
Yes, yes.
Yes, I do have a question, though. What about?
Go ahead.
Yosha talked mm-hmm. about how that he gave, that Moses gave them a writ of divorce because of the hardness of their heart, and that it wasn't like that from the beginning, wasn't supposed to be like that from the beginning, and that the only cause for divorce really in the father's eyes was adultery.
Yeah, you know, you always have to be careful of when you're dealing with any statement that's attributed to Yahusha is that the so-called Christian New Testament is an extraordinarily poorly maintained document. If you look at the oldest 69 manuscripts that predate Constantine, there are 300,000 known variants between them and the basis of English translations. There's only 182,000 words, so there's almost twice as many variants as there are words. If you're dealing with a statement that isn't extant in the pre-Constantine writings, the likelihood of it being accurate is extraordinarily remote. In addition to that, you're dealing with a translation of a translation when you speak of it in English. So there's lots of issues there. Now, but let me just address this your point about adultery. Yahweh has a lot to say about adultery. A lot. But very little of what he has to say about adultery happens to be about a man or a woman having an adulterous affair while being married. One of the statements that he etched in stone was about adultery, not making a habit of adultery. If you look at what God has to say about adultery, and it's presented most vividly in the book of Hosea, which means salvation. From God's perspective, adultery, that the kind of adultery that he's concerned about is not choosing to divorce a man or a woman, depending on if you're a man or a woman, but instead of you choosing to have affairs with gods created by men. By choosing to be religious, from God's perspective, you're being adulterous. Yahweh divorced himself from Yisrael. He actually uses the term divorce. And he divorced himself from Yisrael because Yisrael was adulterous. He wasn't talking about Yisrael's men or women having illicit sexual affairs with other men and women outside of marriage. The covenant is a marriage vow. And he said, because you've rejected my covenant, because you've broken this covenant, this marriage relationship that I have with you, you're adulterous. And so when Yosha makes a statement like that, to the degree we can be certain of what he said, what we find is that the only way that you can verify what he said is it consistent with something that Yahweh said. And what Yahweh said is that you become adulterous when you embrace a religious God. So I don't want to speak personally about your situation, Carol, but a man who imposes Pauline doctrine on his wife is an adulterer from Yahweh's perspective. Does that help?
Okay.
Kimberly, do you have any other questions on this? Or, you know, one of the things that I have really wanted to do for a long time is to dive into Romans 7, because it is easily the most insane rant I have probably ever witnessed. So I'd love to go into it, and because it's about a woman being freed of her husband and therefore being freed of the Torah through the husband's death, which is analogous to the Torah's death. But since One of the things that Yosha said is that by acknowledging him, by choosing to embrace what he has said and done, by following him, which means you'd be Torah observant, that what you're going to find is division. Husbands and wives divided, fathers and sons divided. It does bring division. The vast majority of people are going to reject the terms and conditions of the covenant. They reject Yahweh. So what you're experiencing is common. How you handle it is your decision. But, I'm certainly willing to go more into or share anything that I can from Yah's testimony or dispel anything I can from Paul's testimony if it's helpful. So, Kimberly, you have any other questions or thoughts that you'd like addressed?
No, I was actually calling in to encourage Carol to just stand her ground. I've remained bold, and I refuse to back down, and, so far it's working for me. Now, the comment you just made, you were so correct on that. You definitely have division, but for me, I love Yah more than anything. And the thing that bothers me the most, Yada, is that the family members or friends, whoever you're trying to speak with, they don't take the time to look into it themselves.
Correct.
It's just, like you said, kind of like Paul, these rants.
Right.
Rational. They,
right.
It's a lot to deal with.
As a matter of fact,
on these pagan holidays, I was just told by my husband that that it's ridiculous that the 4th of July is not to be celebrated. And I stood my ground. I refused. And he told me that I need to go to the Middle East somewhere if I'm not going to pay homage. My country. And I said, no, I'm liberated by Yahweh.
Yeah.
I understand, these men went and they fought. But
yeah.
And I was absolutely crazy in his eyes. So,
think of that. That's the comparative, so there may be some issues with the United States, but compared to the worst countries on earth, the Islamic countries, we're better. So if you don't like it here, go to an Islamic country. He's missing the entire point. What Yah's point is, walk away from your country. He didn't say walk to another country. It's just that walk away from your country. Do not be associated with Babel. And he explains that Babel is a religion and politics. Don't be associated with those things. Walk away from them. He didn't say, choose one country over another, did he?
No, he did not.
I don't celebrate the 4th of July either because I'm no longer a patriot. I ceased being a patriot the more I learned about my government. And then the more I learned about the terms and conditions of the covenant, what God said and what I learned about my country were in absolute perfect unison. What I learned about my country said my country is immoral. It ought not be trusted. I ought not rely on my country because they're actually working against our citizens. And the dependence upon our nation is counterproductive, and celebrating our nation with all of the things that our government is doing that are inappropriate and immoral is inappropriate and immoral. But that happened to be 100% harmonious with what Yahweh was saying as well. That's why he wants us to walk away from our country, and what you've chosen to do is right. Trust and rely on him. He's dependable.
Well, I'm definitely going to have more battles coming up.
And you will. And the reason that there is this division is that the whole concept of the covenant is about division. Yahusha said, I didn't come to bring peace. I came to bring division. And what is the division? The proposition that Yahweh is offering us is that we can choose to be aligned with and dependent upon and celebrate, be patriotic to, if you will, religious to, show faith in the institutions of man. Or We can choose to walk to him, which means to walk away from the institutions of man, to embrace what he has to offer, what he has to say, to embrace him. But to embrace him means walking away from human institutions. And so the very aspect of the covenant and what he is proposing in its terms and conditions bring division. It's a choice. It's the very choice that Adam and Chawa had in the garden. It's the very choice that we have today. You can choose to embrace human institutions and be patriotic and political and religious, to support the military. That's one choice. And you have the right to make that choice. The consequences of that choice are grievous, but that's nonetheless a choice that we are all given the right to make. Or you can choose to embrace Yahweh. You cannot have both. You've made the right call.
I wanted to make another comment. On divorce, what you just read, that just verified, actually, that question that I was calling in, as well as in support of Carol, because there was a difference. My sister and I, you know, I think that she had maybe misunderstood. Oh.
Go ahead. You finish your thought. You finish your thought, and then we'll go to commercial.
Go ahead.
Well, actually, we only have about 15 seconds. So if you'll stay with us through the break, we'll have 6 minutes on the other side, Kimberly. Love to hear your insights, and we'll return with Carol and Kimberly talking about divorce and adultery and all things Torah teaching from Yah after the commercial break. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm just here quickly searching the Matanyah comments that Yosha is attributed to make relative to adultery. Now, first, it's interesting that in Yahochanan, where the adulterous woman is allegedly brought before Yahusha, and he draws something in the sand and said, you know, he without sin cast the first stone, and since, you know, they don't judge you, I don't judge you either. That whole diatribe beginning in Yahochanan, John 8, with the first verse, did not occur. You can't even find that statement in any manuscript prior to, I believe it is the 8th century. And prior to that, they all go from the end of the 7th chapter to about the 13th verse in the 8th chapter. So that statement is completely made up. The statement that is interesting, of course, is in Matanyah 19:9, just loosely presented. It says, "And I say to you, whoever shall put away his wife." Put away, well, I could look up the Greek word, but he didn't speak Greek in this particular case. But you can assume distance oneself from one's wife, except it be for, and the English versions say, either adultery or fornication. But the Greek word that's translated here is poneros, which is actually a term that speaks on corruption and perversion. It doesn't have to do with necessarily with sexuality. It, in fact, it mostly has to do with the corruption and perversion that is associated with religion. So he said that that this person then would be committing adultery, and whoever marries her is put away, doth committed adultery. Who knows what in the world was actually said, but anyway, that's kind of a quick review of it. Kimberly, you're making a point from the perspective of your sister. Go ahead and share that.
It could have been that verse there that maybe she was referring to or whatever. I think she thought she had heard on a previous airing or something when you maybe this got brought up, this topic got brought up or whatever. And I'm sorry, I get really nervous.
That's okay.
What you just read is how
yes.
I felt. Because we're, you know, because of being liberated, you know, being liberated by Yah.
Yes.
I just couldn't see that. Now, wait a minute. I have to stay with him through all this, you know, I mean, he's going to leave me anyway eventually because he's sick and tired of it. But let that be his choice, you know.
Yeah, I was just looking up this that statement, which is recorded in Matignon 19:9, which would be if it was. I have a tendency to value statements that are in Matignon and Yohanan way over statements that are in Mark and Luke, because Yohanan and Matignon are not presenting hearsay. They were eyewitnesses. They were disciples. And although Matignon was originally written in Hebrew, and so we now have a translation of a translation into English, guess what? As I had suspected, it's not extant in any pre-Constantine document. We go from 14:3 through 5 through 20, 24 through 32, and have nothing of the 19th chapter. And if you were to look at Mark, it's in Mark 10, one that would also be the same thing. We have some from P45, a little bit of Mark 9, and then we go to the very end of Mark 11 and do not have it besides that. So you're dealing with a statement here that is very difficult to demonstrate. It is extant in a pre-Constantine manuscript of Luke, but the problem you have with Luke is everything that Luke reports is hearsay. Mark at least has some credibility in the sense that Mark served as the translator. Mark was actually not the man's name. He was a Hebrew individual, and he served as Shimon Kefish, whom you know as Peter. It's a translator. And so Mark is actually comprised of what Shimon Kefish, Peter, shared with him as he was making presentations around the world. And Luke is just 100% hearsay. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but Carol, Kimberly, I really appreciate your contribution to the program. This is an important subject, and I hope you both call back, because I would love an excuse to jump into Romans 7 and present the insanity of Paul's writings. This has been Shattering Myths for today. We'll be with you at this time again tomorrow. May God bless you all.